Seventh-day Baptists came out to California during the Gold Rush, and they would just be scattered alone, keeping the Sabbath alone in their remote locations. No church, very little community, and a minister would travel up and down the coast once a year to visit each of them. And so I just realized not only how different Seventh-day Baptists are now from Seventh-day Adventists, but also just what the ecumenical power of the Sabbath is. You could believe all sorts of things, and yet there's something about the Sabbath that ties people together across geographical distance, across doctrinal differences. That was just so striking to me, and it totally changed my perspective on the Sabbath, and that became a major theme in my work.
The Lineage Journey podcast, unscripted conversations that aim to help you on the journey of discovering your lineage. Join us as we take a deeper look into past lineage episodes and see the lessons we can learn for today.
Michelle Lee is a native of California and has received her education at some of the finest schools in America, including Stanford University in the Bay Area. It was there that she met my wife and where they worked together doing ministry on campus. She was later in my wedding party as a bridesmaid, but that's not why she is with us today. She is possibly a rarity, a female historian. Recently, she obtained her doctorate in history from the University of Texas at Austin and has conducted some fascinating research that we are going to discuss today. A young female historian with much to offer, and we are glad to have her with us. So with us today in the studio, we have Michelle Lee, or should I say Dr. Michelle Lee. I believe you recently graduated with a PhD. Maybe you could, we're going to discuss a little bit about your studies in history, who you are, what the process has been like, etc. But just briefly, like background, where did you get your PhD from and how recently ago did you get it?
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here. My name's Michelle and I recently graduated in 2019 with my PhD in religious studies, with a focus on the history of religion in the Americas from the University of Texas at Austin.
Okay.
So prior to that, I earned my master's and my bachelor's at Stanford University in history as well.
So you've done history bachelor's, history master's, and history and PhD.
I have.
So you are quite well versed in history.
I guess you could say that.
Where did you get this passion for history from? Because I like history, but I don't often meet many other people that have studied it at all those levels.
That's a great question. And it's part of my testimony. I, like most students at Stanford, I started off as a pre-med. And then I had a conversion experience through secular campus ministries.
Hmm.
And I decided to take a year off of school to go to a campus missionary training program.
In Michigan.
Oh,
okay.
And there I was taking a class on Bible prophecy, and I had actually never really been exposed in great detail to Bible prophecy. And as I was studying it, I just remember chills going down my spine and just thinking, I wonder if I could share God through history.
Hmm.
And that thought continued to grow and that conviction continued to deepen. I had grown up telling myself that I would never get a PhD in history. It was actually something specifically that I said I would never do.
Oh, wow.
I also told myself if I ever get a PhD, it will never be in religious studies. And I ended up doing those two things. So
you
I started,
won the course pre-med. How many years did you do in pre-med? Just 1 year?
Just 1 year. Okay. I was a little bit lost. I wasn't sure what to do, but everyone was doing pre-med. And so that was what I decided to do. And then during this year off, which was actually a huge step of faith for me because it was off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought I was going to go to Stanford, be there for 4 years and then go to medical school. And here I was taking leave of absence for a year.
What did your parents make of that?
There was resistance. They thought that I had lost my marbles, but eventually they came around to it. And I came back to Stanford. I was actually so convicted that God wanted me to study history and share him through history that without taking a single history class, I declared a history major.
Wow. So you switched right away.
I just switched. And then God had several miracles in line for me to show me that that was what he wanted me to do. And I knew that once I committed to studying history as an undergrad, that I would go all the way and get a PhD as well. And that it would become my mission to share, to become a historian, and that I would take it as far as I could go.
Was there a particular period you studied in your undergrad, when you're doing your BA, or was it? Yeah.
Yes. I studied American history for my undergrad. I also so it was a double major in East Asian studies. And so I developed that competency as well. Stanford has kind of a strength in East Asian studies. And so I was able to combine those two interests. Then I stayed for another year to earn my master's, and that was in East Asian history. By that point, I was pretty convinced that I wanted to study American missionaries in East Asia. It's a topic that's not studied very much. You're also dealing with some difficult themes for Christians to grapple with, like colonialism and mission work. And I just saw that kind of gap in the literature, as we say. And so I actually studied and presented on Adventist missionaries in Korea during the colonial period between 1910 and 1945. Then I got to grad school, and life took me in a different direction.
So maybe just briefly, I know we're not going to go too much in depth on it, but what was your general area of your study for your PhD?
For my PhD, I actually started off at UT wanting to study Adventist missionaries in Korea during the colonial period. So just a continuation of my studies. I'd received a lot of support and developed my language skills there in Japanese and Korean, and thought that that's what I would do when I got to UT. I found out very quickly that UT does not have the same focus on East Asia and the same resources. And I started to question that project, particularly with all the language training involved. I still think it's a really important topic for us to address.
Yeah, there are some fascinating stories, I think.
Yeah, both as, you know, both as historians, professionally trained historians, that's an area that needs a lot of research. But then also as a church, we need to explore the topic of mission work. Just in general, you know, at the high school level or academy, you don't hear about missionaries very much when you go to history class.
True, yeah.
But I got there, and so I started questioning what I was going to study, and came to a point where I still remember so distinctly one night I was sitting in my little house in the country outside of Austin, and I was looking out the window at the stars, and I was like, Lord, I don't know why you brought me here. This is the one school that I did not expect to go to for my PhD. And here I am. They don't offer many resources for what I want to study. And what is it that you want me to study? And I just heard this voice and deep conviction, study the Sabbath, study the history of the Sabbath. And it just struck me right away. This is what I'm going to do. I was so excited, and immediately went and told my advisor, I want to switch my topic to the history of the Sabbath in America.
And that was fine.
That was, yeah. There was support for it. I think she's a little bit surprised, but she did support that. And it became a project unlike what I could have ever dreamed when I first decided to become a historian. I never, ever thought that I would touch that topic.
Wow. Okay. So you got your PhD last year. What's
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Well, of course, I forget 2020 existed. It's almost like, I always think last year is 2019. I'm sure I'm not the only one who does that. So you got it 2 years ago now, 2019. What's the process like for getting a PhD? I mean, I've never gone through that. What did it look like?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Some of our listeners may be thinking, you know, they want to study as well, or, you know, they just may be interested. What explain a little bit.
The advice that I got when I was an undergrad, when I was talking to my advisors, and I said, I want to get a PhD in history. They said, don't get a PhD in history unless there's nothing else that you can see yourself doing. It is very difficult to get a doctoral degree in the humanities, just a doctoral degree, period. But then in the humanities, the job scarcity is just so intense. And so I did it only because I felt very called to it. Of course, I think the more technical parts of it depend on the country that you're in. But I got my bachelor's, got my master's right after that. Then I was advised to take some time to make sure this is what I really wanted. And so I ended up teaching at a self-supporting institution in Arkansas for a year. And that was my wilderness experience. And then I think the Lord was preparing me to live in the South, because then I went to Texas for that. And it is a commitment. It's a 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year process for a PhD in the humanities. In history, certainly, that's approximately how much time you'll spend, depending on the language training you need. And I think the best piece of advice that I got going into it is to treat it like a job. So I had a mentor at Stanford who said, what I did when I went through my PhD program is I went to the library from 9 to 5, and I didn't let anyone interrupt me during that time. I treated it like my job. And then I went home and I was with my family. And that was the approach that I took throughout the dissertation writing process.
So is the majority of your PhD time, this may sound very basic, and if it is, that you can just laugh and say, that's a silly question, but is it actually classroom time or is it predominantly research time?
Yeah. So for a PhD in history in the United States, usually it's 2 years of classwork at the beginning. So you're reading, you know, all sorts of theory and you're taking classes or you're doing research papers, whatnot. And then in the third year, you study for your qualifying exams. For me, that meant reviewing the things that I had studied in the first 2 years, plus reading about 200 books. And then you take a written exam or several.
200 books?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
And then take a series of written exams. And it depends on the program.
And then after that, you kind of...
And then you enter candidacy, which means that you've been approved to then embark on the dissertation writing process.
So it's a pretty thorough process.
Can be.
So then you get approved for... You present a proposal, I'm guessing.
You do propose your project.
So your PhD was you said you prayed and God told you to do it on the Sabbath. Is there a particular direction with the Sabbath that you went?
Yeah.
In your research?
The project evolved a lot over time. So UT Strength, the grad program that I went to, is to train historians hemispherically. So not just religion in North America, but religion in Latin America as well. And so my specialty is religion in the Americas. At first, I thought I would just look at how Adventists have talked about the Sabbath over time.
Okay.
That project very quickly grew to now looking at how Adventists, Seventh-day Baptists, other minority Seventh-day Keepers, alongside Jews and other Protestants and Catholics, have dealt with the question of sacred time in the American West. So in some ways it got broader, in some ways it got more narrow. And it allowed me to ask a question that I still find very interesting, which is how do certain ideas and practices about sacred time take on more power than others in a society? So to word that more simply, it's how do certain ideas gain more power than others, and certain religious practices. And of course, as an Adventist, I'm very interested in the Sabbath question. And so that became the question that I asked as I was doing the research. Then I had to choose a geographical focus, or I chose to look specifically at California from the Gold Rush onward. And that presented, actually, I didn't quite know where I was going with that. I just knew I love California. I love doing research here. I'm from California. But I actually realized I saw God's leading in that question over time, because California is a place without a Protestant establishment, unlike Massachusetts or the more eastern part of the United States. And when gold is discovered in California in 1848, by 1849, there's a worldwide gold rush here. How do then people come in and establish ideas about sacred time in a place without a strong Protestant establishment, which is what we normally associate with quote unquote Sabbath keeping or Sunday keeping in America?
There's something to compare it to, or is it just kind of, it was wild?
Right. Well, yeah, that's kind of the way that people view it. And so you very quickly find that Protestants, Sunday keeping Protestants, do come in, and they, within just a few years of California entering the Union, pass laws for Sunday sacrality. It's amazing how quickly that happens, despite California having none of that history that, for example, the Massachusetts Bay Colony has.
So your wider research, are you planning to publish this? Is there a book on the horizon?
I'm revising my dissertation into a book right now. So stay tuned.
Sounds interesting. We'll look out for that. And is there kind of, would you say, are there anything to say about the direction of our study on these subjects, how it's going? Is the study that you're doing different based on your generation as a millennial from previous generations in Adventist history or Christian history?
So I can speak to kind of the direction of Adventist history and how I see that going right now. I think that we're beginning to ask more questions about what life was like for the average Adventist. So when I typically think of Adventist history, or maybe when listeners typically think of Adventist history, they think of Ellen White, J.N. Andrews, Hiram Edson, you know, these Uriah Smith, these big names. And Adventist history as it is now, I perceive as very institutional. So you learn about the history of institutions. Now, and I think this follows the trend of just history as a field more broadly, you see people like myself, my colleagues in Adventist history asking, well, what was Sabbath like for the average Adventist? Or how have Adventists dealt with the question of race or gender over time? So these questions are starting to come up. And I think it's super exciting because we look for ourselves in history. We look to see ourselves reflected in that. And if we continue to teach just a North American institutional story with a few main figures, I'm afraid that we're going to cease to speak to the church. When I think about the average classroom, it's so diverse now. Of course, it depends where you're at. But students look for themselves in history. They ask, you know, where are the women? Where are the minorities?
How can they connect with history?
Exactly. And I think that's true of, you know, both Adventist classrooms and non-Adventist classrooms. And so I see the questions I ask are, I think, very different than those of a generation ago. And I think there's strengths to both.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe. Let me ask another question about your research, if you don't mind. When I think of PhD, and you mentioned you've got to do your classwork and then you do your exams and candidacy and then you go into your research, what is the process of research like? And I ask that question today because a lot of people say, well, they do research. And their research often involves going to Google and typing a question in Google, and they get an answer, and then they read an article. So maybe I'm insulting your intelligence here and whatnot, but what does research look like as a PhD student, as someone that's going beneath the surface who doesn't consider Wikipedia to be a authoritative source? What does it look like to research a particular subject? How do you go about it?
I actually do use Wikipedia.
Oh, you do? Okay.
It's great.
Oh, that comforts me.
I don't cite Wikipedia, but Wikipedia footnotes are gold. And so I actually recommend that my students look at Wikipedia. Not to cite it, but there's some great sources to be found. Yeah, that's a good question, Adam, because there's so much that's open access now. And so what can a professional historian do that maybe someone who's not trained in history, what's the difference there? Gosh, that's a hard question. I think that for me, and it really depends on what kind of history you're doing. I studied the 19th and 20th century. So that's the 1800s. And for me, the early 1900s. So I'm often dealing with written materials. The average day of research for me would be going to an archive. I would try to get a grant to go there, and larger institutions can be very generous with the sort of funding that they give you. And so you get a travel grant to go. And then you arrive at the library, you say, I want to look at the diaries of this individual. So they'll page the materials. It'll take, you know, anywhere from a few minutes to a few days to get there. Then you're standing in the archive or sitting in the archive looking at, you know, someone's diary from the 1800s. It's so exciting. And I always tell my friends, if you want to be famous, make sure you have good handwriting in your diaries because you can use them later. So then you're looking through the diaries and you're trying to answer a particular historical question. For example, how did this French woman living in San Francisco in 1855 spend her Sundays? So then you're looking at all the Sunday entries and you're trying to answer that question. You're taking notes, taking pictures, and you come back home. And what I love about history is that it's storytelling. So you're trying to fill in the gaps and say, okay, what story can I tell based on the evidence here? What story can I responsibly tell about this person? And that's the process of archival research. Now, other people deal with materials like, you know, pottery or sacred objects. Really depends on what your questions are and what access you have. And I think actually the really cool thing as an Adventist is that we have so many materials that are available to us.
That's true. Yeah.
Just on the internet, the Adventist Archives website is great. And then if you show up there, they do have many more materials you can look at in person. But the amount of digitized materials that we have for studying Adventist history is, I think, almost unparalleled.
Really?
Compared to any American denomination. Maybe the Mormons.
Yeah, they do have a pretty thorough so you're looking at a lot of original source materials.
Correct.
Would you say?
Yeah, and then you're at the same time you're also looking at secondary sources. You're looking at what other scholars have written about your topic and trying to either argue with them or agree or add to what they've done, and you're making a contribution in that way as well.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a short break now, and then after the break, we're going to look at maybe zeroing in a few questions on what it's like to be a female historian and how that plays out. I'm sure that's very different. And what it's like to be a woman in this field, and what if I wanted to get a PhD? A few other questions we'll get into just after our break. So stay tuned. Stay with us for this Lineage Journey podcast.
Lineage is a nonprofit organization kept running by generous donors like you. Support us today on patreon.com/lineagejourney.
History shapes identity. Identity shapes mission. And a clear mission determines the trajectory of your future. Knowing where you come from is key to understanding your present purpose and your future mission. Lineage Journey is a series of videos that will take you on a journey through time, discovering the key people and events that have shaped the Christian faith. From the Waldenses to Martin Luther to Zwingli, from England to France, Switzerland to Germany, the light broke over the horizon of Europe, piercing through the Dark Ages, and then spread out over the world. As the United States of America rose to supremacy, Christianity formed the bedrock of this great nation. And so from the Great Awakening to the Great Disappointment and beyond, Lineage follows the journey of God's church throughout time, immersing you in the places, the stories, and the people through whom Christianity has shone the brightest. Join us on a journey through time. Follow us on social media at Lineage Journey, or check out our website at lineagejourney.com. Lineage Journey not only produces video content, but instructive and illuminating resources to teach young and old about Christian history. Lineage has produced an educational coloring book for people of all ages. It includes original artwork from Ashley Bloom, highlighting the various heroes of the Reformation. Each scene has a matching story, and there are also QR codes to connect you to the website for more information and to watch the videos. There are also fun facts and memorable quotes to accompany the scenes to color in. Designed for young and old alike, get your copy now at lineagejourney.com.
So welcome back. We have looked at a few things so far with Michelle Lee. We've looked at kind of why she went into studying history, and she shared her personal testimony of how that came about and how she went through the process and what it looks like to get a PhD and what the average day looked like. So maybe just ask another question on that, because I find it fascinating. You know, you go to a place and you get, you know, someone's diary and you're reading through the history of their life. What would you say is the best archive you got to see, or the most interesting or unique archive you got to see and research that stands out to you the most, that you kind of really got excited when you saw it?
That's a loaded question. They're all so unique in their own ways.
Sure, maybe a couple of them then.
Sure. I think going to either private collections or smaller church archives are really interesting. They're not as regulated. Some of them I feel like I could just eat a cheeseburger in them. And you just have free access to all these materials. I think one of the most memorable visits I had was going to the Seventh-day Baptist Archive in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Okay.
It's very remote. I remember driving out there and thinking, wow, this general conference is kind of just in the middle of rural Wisconsin.
Huh.
And I guess I'd had this conception that Seventh-day Baptists and Seventh-day Adventists are very similar because we both keep the Sabbath. Of course, we learned about the Sabbath from Seventh-day mm-hmm. Baptists historically. Mm-hmm. And I showed up, and as I was looking through their materials and speaking with the individuals working in that building, I realized very quickly that we have two very different denominational structures. And it just gave me a new understanding of God's special calling on the Adventist church for this time. Seventh-day Baptists do not have 28 fundamental beliefs the way that we have. They're just loosely tied together through their common belief in and practice of Sabbath keeping.
Okay.
Other than that, doctrinally, it's quite diverse. And that was what I was beginning to realize. That also struck me very deeply in the archives as I was looking at their materials. Seventh-day Baptists came out to California during the Gold Rush, and they would just be scattered alone, keeping the Sabbath alone in their remote locations. No church, very little community.
Oh, wow.
And a minister would travel up and down the coast once a year to visit each of them. And so I just realized not only how different Seventh-day Baptists are now from Seventh-day Adventists, but also just what the ecumenical power of the Sabbath is. You could believe all sorts of things, and yet there's something about the Sabbath that ties people together across geographical distance, across doctrinal differences. That was just so striking to me, and it totally changed my perspective on the Sabbath, and that became a major theme in my work.
Okay. Would that be a surprise you had, or are there surprises you've had along the way as well?
In my research?
Yeah.
Yeah, there have been a lot of surprises, but you'll have to wait for the book.
Okay. No problem. I will wait for the book. So, what's it like as a female historian? And that's a very blunt question, but from my general knowledge on my head, there's not too many female historians, at least in our faith community. I'm not sure outside of our church what that looks like, if there are or if there aren't, but I know at least within our church, there's not that many. In the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So any thoughts on why that is or what's it like?
I'll actually back up a little bit.
Okay.
I think I began to grapple with the question of what it's like to be a female just in the secular workplace or in academia when I was an undergrad at Stanford. Obviously a prestigious institution that God providentially led me to. And that's another story for another time. But I began to ask myself, I'm paying so much for this education. I'm gaining so much here. And what happens if I never use this? And so this is the question that began to plague me as an undergrad. I just thought, man, I'm going to have to carry this the rest of my life. I went to this great school, had great professors. And what if God calls me to the mission field? What if God calls me to be a wife and a mother and I don't end up using my professional degree? And I asked that question throughout undergrad, through my master's, and throughout my PhD program. PhD program is a huge investment of time and just emotional energy. It takes so much out of you. You're not only learning new professional skills, but you're also acting within a professional environment, undergoing a process of socialization into academia. And you're thinking, at the end of all this, am I going to have a job? What if I never have a chance to use this degree as a female, you know, if I'm committed to marriage and family in a particular way where I won't be teaching. And of course, everyone approaches career differently. And the Lord led me to this conclusion. And this is the little bit of insight that I have to offer from many years in academia, which is I have to treat my time in higher education as a calling. And that itself is enough. And so if my 5-6 years getting my PhD is my only exposure to academia, that's enough, because God can use me in that time to have crucial conversations with colleagues, to learn more about the world, you know, to reach other individuals for Christ. And at the end of the day, I can walk away from this and be completely free and not have that burden. As a female historian in the Adventist Church, there's not many of us. In fact, you know, you and I were talking before this, and we could only maybe think of two or three. And forgive me if I'm missing others, but I think that I'm learning more about my own positionality, and that's a fancy way of saying I'm learning more about how who I am affects my work. For example, I think that I want to know how women who convert to Adventism have dealt with certain questions historically. That's one very specific question. But what about being a minority woman in the 1960s in America and being Adventist and seeing things in the news? And so I think you start to ask different questions based on life experience, and that's natural. Everyone does that. But certainly the career question is one that I've really seen God work providentially in, and it just lifts the burden. For example, I never thought that my career would take the direction that it has, and yet I'm at perfect peace with it. And so that's just my advice to any woman, but just really anyone considering higher education, is to treat that itself
as your calling,
as a calling.
I think that's key, that people know what their calling is, whatever it might be, and stick to that and be sure of that. And so thanks for sharing that. I think that's very important, and also encouraging to people that are listening. So what if someone's listening and they're asking the question, what if they want to get a PhD? What advice would you give them?
Well, that's...
I mean, you said that when you were younger, you said, I'm never going to do that, but...
Yeah. The advice that I got when I started the PhD program... And God has his way of calling you, you know, and so that's not for me to speak to, but higher education, like I've mentioned, is so intense. You're drinking in so much intellectually and socially. And the advice that I got was to have a daily diet of scripture and prayer, but also to find community. And I think without those two, I would have been a very unmoored person. So for me, being active in campus ministries, being active with my local church, and having that time in prayer and scripture, I mean, it's through that that I came to the dissertation topic that I did. Those two things absolutely will get you through.
To be rooted in community and rooted in God's word.
It's so easy. I think that actually also really impacts your scholarship. When you're in the ivory tower, it's so theoretical, it's so abstract. You're dealing with questions like power and hegemony, and if you continue connecting with people, then even the audience that you write for becomes different. You know, how readable should my work be? And who am I going to involve in my work? For example, I realized as I was just interacting personally with a lot of Sabbath keepers that they wanted their stories told. They didn't see themselves in that story of Sabbath keeping, aka Sunday keeping, in America that has such Puritan, strict overtones. And I realized that there are all these minority communities that are like, hey, where am I in the narrative? And it was through those personal interactions that started to shape my work.
Okay. I think it's so important keeping that connection. Now, if someone's an amateur historian, I use that word lightly, and we did talk earlier about doing a Google search or Wikipedia, but what are some of the pitfalls for someone who's not a professional historian, for them to avoid, or people who are just interested in history? How can you, I mean, today there's so much information out there. My wife was reading a book recently that she was sharing with me how that there's different kind of theories of how the world would look like today. And one of them was that the society in which we live today, there would be, it's not that the information would be censored, but we live in a society where there's so much information and people would pay attention to none of it because there's just too much out there. They just shut off. So, I mean, there's so much information out there. You see stuff on Facebook, you see stuff on Google, YouTube, blah, 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 blah. If someone's doing research or they're trying to go into a particular subject, you know, what are some of the pitfalls for someone to avoid or someone who's just getting interested? Any tips you could guide? Or any thoughts on that question?
That's a great question. Like you said, there's so much information. I think history is one of those fields. It's so wonderful to be a historian, and it's so frustrating. Go to a dinner party, for example, and people will say, well, what do you do for work? And I'll say, I'm a historian. And they'll say, oh, have you heard about this war in 1546? And, you know.
You think you know every piece of history.
Right. And you're thinking, I have no idea what you're talking about. But that's also the lovely thing about history is that it's so accessible. Mm-hmm. And my brother likes to joke, oh, you got a PhD in reading because anyone can read about history. But I think that one of the pitfalls that I often see people falling into, at least here in the States, when it comes to history, is that they're very drawn to historical facts and particular historical events. For example, the Civil War has lots of people who can regurgitate all the dates and all the generals. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But I think that then we can lose focus of other interesting questions, for example. And I think also spiritual questions, like what is the spiritual significance of the Civil War? I think also it reminds me of Daniel 5. I was reflecting on this recently, and I think this is how people view history as a series of facts and dates, and that's kind of the high school history that you're exposed to. And it's unfortunate because I think that does history a disservice to think of it that way. I think there's actually huge spiritual significance to history.
I agree. Yeah.
As well. And when I read Daniel 5, Daniel comes, you know, into the banqueting room, and Belshazzar has seen the handwriting on the wall. And Daniel actually goes over the history of Nebuchadnezzar and how God worked in Nebuchadnezzar's life. And in verse 22, it says, Daniel tells Belshazzar, he says, and thou, his son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. And then judgment is pronounced on Belshazzar that very night. And if you think about it, God is actually holding Belshazzar accountable on the basis of his family's history. He's saying, you saw God working through Nebuchadnezzar's life, and that was a testimony of who I am and my power. And what my character is, and you've ignored all that history, and you've gone and desecrated the items from the temple and just partied. And Belshazzar is held accountable on the basis of history. And so I think we often fail to realize when we treat history as a series of facts and dates and things to memorize that there's actually sacred significance to it. And a lot of lessons we can draw from history. There's this historian at Harvard, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and she has a saying, and you've probably seen it somewhere on Facebook. It says, well-behaved women seldom make history. And people often interpret that quote as, oh, well, then I need to be a not well-behaved woman in order to make history. And they kind of view it as a call to rebellion. But the point that historian is actually making within the original context of her article is that well-behaved women are seldom written into history books. So the average woman who's doing her job, you know, raising her kids, working that 9-to-5 job is seldom written about in the history books. But I think that's actually where we see a lot of the testimony of God's power. When we look at the average Adventist layperson and their faithfulness, that you see God working in that person's life, not just Ellen White's life or whoever else's life. They have some amazing stories to tell of God's providence in big and little ways. And I'm so glad that Adventist history is moving in that direction. And so I think that that's one way to see the spiritual significance of history as well.
Okay.
It's not just in the big dates and facts.
Yeah. In Lineage, we have a phrase that we use or one of the people said, why do you do lineage? And we said, well, you know, we share history videos, but and articles and so on, and now podcast. But part of the reason we do this is to help people understand their identity. And I think the point you brought up there was that history shouldn't just be like Civil War, learning the dates and the generals and the battles and how many died and how many survived and so on. But we have to look at the moral lessons through history and how we can apply that to our lives today. And I think that kind of helps people today know what their identity or what their purpose in life is when they know the past. I think when people don't know the past, it disconnects them from the present and leads to directionless people.
I used to hate that saying, you know, like, if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it, or some variation of that. But I actually think history is so powerful because history challenges you to question your assumptions in the present, because they weren't always that way. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't always think about the Sabbath this way, or in America, or whatever it is, whatever assumption or belief or practice you have. And so when you look at the past and you see it was different, you're actually in a position to then ask yourself, how do I justify what I do now in the present? Is it just because we've always done it this way, or because my parents told me to do it this way, or do I have some other deeper basis for it? And for me, that's the real kind of moral lesson in history, is displacing what we accept as normal or normative in the present.
What would you say is the spiritual impact of studying history has had on you?
I think in addition to the things that we've discussed, it's just the opportunity to talk with people from so many different walks of life. The Sabbath is a beautiful topic. I'm only talking about my experience.
Sure.
But being able to talk to people about rest is such an amazing experience. There are so many religious traditions that have a day of rest or period of rest or a place of sacrality. And being able to connect with people throughout the PhD process as a young historian has been so rewarding. I have colleagues who are Jewish, who are not affiliated with any sort of religious tradition. And those conversations for me have been some of the most transformational.
Thank you. Final question. Well, maybe there'll be another one after this, we'll see. Is you studied history, you studied it at a secular institution, University of Texas, and before that, Stanford. But then you also said you had experience with campus ministry. Are there any, to someone who's listening who's a Christian, who may be going to a public school? Because I believe, if my understanding of the numbers are correct, the majority of Christians don't study at Christian institutions. They're actually studying at secular or non-Christian institutions. What advice would you have for someone who's studying in a secular institution?
So I was trained in the field of religious studies, which is the secular study of religion.
Okay.
It is not supportive, at least in theory, of scholars who are professing. And so I think this is a super important question. Because if you know that you're taking a religion class at a secular university and it's being taught from a certain point of view, I think you'll realize that it will challenge you very much. People often think of the sciences as being where religion is viewed in a hostile manner, or personal religious belief and practice, I should say. But I actually find that the humanities are very much a challenging place for professing Christians. And I would just go back to that advice that we discussed before, which is that daily diet of scripture and prayer, and then also sharing it so that it's not theory, it's real life. There are students, fellow students out there who have questions, who are struggling. And you have such an opportunity to come near them and be their friend and share in that way. That's my advice. Ellen White has a chapter in Third Selected Messages called Attending the Colleges and Universities of Our Land. And I would recommend that anyone considering going to a secular university who's a Christian or Adventist would read that. It has amazing advice, written actually at a very crucial time in the history of the University of Michigan. And she's writing specifically to students at the University of Michigan, Adventist students who are going there. The University of Michigan is undergoing this transformation into the German university model, which is very secular. They're getting rid of their mandatory chapel services, and they're transforming at this very historical moment that Ellen White writes. And I believe that the University of Michigan at that point was transforming into the university that we see today, the big research university. And she has excellent advice. I'll allow the listeners to read it for themselves, but that would be my recommendation.
Thank you. Yeah, I've read that chapter as well. It's a fascinating chapter. And I think, like you say, anyone who's studying at a secular institution, it's important for them to be spiritually prepared for the challenges that they face.
Absolutely. And I think it only takes one person. When I was a student at Stanford, I was the only Adventist that I knew of.
Wow.
And, well, it was me and your wife, actually. She was working at the church nearby as a Bible worker. And I thought, well, I'd really like to see an Adventist community here. And it was me and her going door to door in my dorm, my freshman dorm, trying to find people who wanted to join our Bible study. And it's amazing. And I'm like, I would just pray and God would allow me to meet other Adventists just walking down the street on campus. And so I knew God was leading. And over time, God grew that campus ministry. And it was such a blessing. That's actually part of the reason that I decided to be rebaptized. I had a conversion experience through that. And so there's nothing that's ever lost from just sticking your foot out there for Christ. That has been a transformational experience for me.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing on that. And I think encourage anyone who's listening to get involved in a campus ministry. If they're at their university or if there's not one, then seek for ways that you can get one started, because we need that type of ministry on public university campuses. You did a year at one, right? Training, and then you started one in Stanford. Excellent. Well, thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing on this important study of history and how it impacts who we are and our role today. And for those of you who are listening, I would encourage you that if you are studying at a secular school, institution of higher learning, that you really understand and have a clear grasp of who you are and why you're there, and may that guide your mission and your purpose, and that you would, you know, really follow. I think one of the things listening to Michelle's testimony is that the subject that she studied, it was because she really felt called to study that subject. And, you know, maybe it's not history for you, but whatever line of study that you're in or occupation, make it something that you are called to do. And when you're in your calling and you know that your purpose is clear, then it's so much easier to live a life that's fulfilled and a life where you can fulfill the mission that God has called for you. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Michelle, for being here with us and for sharing. And thank you for your ministry and your contribution to research in the realm of history. And I'm looking forward to your book when it comes out. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys for listening. And we look forward to connecting with you on a future episode of the Lineage Journey podcast.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Lineage Journey is supported by your generous donations. Did you know that you can donate on a monthly basis? Any amount, from $2 to $100 or whatever you decide, through patreon.com/lineagejourney. Your donations go towards the cost of producing our varied content, and we thank you for your support.